We're continuing in Acts. We're in chapter 23, and now we're at verse 16. But the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, and he came and entered the barracks to talk or to tell Paul. So we first hear here that Paul has a sister and a nephew. They may have been part of a group who traveled with Paul when they came up to Jerusalem. By some hearsay of someone gossiping, this young person got wind of the plot to kill his uncle. I sometimes speculate, it's possible, but we can only speculate, that one of the honest Pharisees that felt they were being railroaded and he didn't like what was going on, he may have got wind of it and decided to do something. Or in God's providence, somebody heard about this and got it to this young man, and so he goes and tells his uncle. Verse 17, so Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, lead this young man to the commander, for he has something to report to him. Paul would have been allowed at visitors, and after he heard what the boy said, he calls the centurion to tell him he must take him to the commander himself, and there's something he wants to tell him. But he did not tell the centurion. Verse 18. So he, the centurion, took and led him to the commander and said, Paul, the prisoner called me to him and asked me to lead this young man to you since he has something to tell you. Verse 18. The centurion here would not know the information, and it would not have inquired. It would have not been his business. So he took the young man to the commander and states that Paul, the prisoner, says he has something to report to you. So he would have assumed something that the commander had to know about. Verse 19, and the commander took him by the hand and, stepping aside, began to inquire of him privately, what is it that you have to report to me? Most likely he was in his office, and there would be other soldiers and people attending him, so he probably walked him over to a corner and whispered to find out what was going on here. Took him by the hand. This gives us a hint. He was not older than 14 or 15. Most likely no older than that. He was most likely not 16, even though the scripture says a young man, there's several words that could be used. But the Romans, they did not consider someone. They had a special ceremony that was very important. And when they're like senators and people in position, they threw big parties and had an official time when they were recognized and they were putting on certain adult robes. And it was at 16. Up until this time, anyone under that could be treated as a child. So this is why he took him by the hand. He would not have taken him by the hand if he considered him an adult, which he did not. So we could basically assume he was most likely somewhere between 9 and 15. If he had been younger, they would have used the word to describe a little boy. And from the young man's conversation, it doesn't appear he was very little. So this just gives us a general idea. He was probably in his early teens. Now we come down to verse 20 and 21 we'll read together. And he said, and this is the teenager or the boy, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down tomorrow to the council as though they were going to inquire somewhat more thoroughly about him. So do not listen to them. Notice that would be typical of a young person. An adult would not give this unsolicited advice to someone as high as this commander was. So it shows the childish way with him, and he's concerned about his uncle. So he says, do not listen to them, for more than 40 of them are lying in wait for him, who have bound themselves under a curse not to eat or drink until they slay him. And now they are ready and waiting for the promise from you. So he repeats to the commander what he has told his uncle Paul. Verse 22, so the commander let the young man go, instructing him, tell no one that you have notified me of these things. The reason for this, he wanted to keep it private. You had to tell no one. Bribery and getting information and giving information was a way often soldiers and slaves made extra money. They would often prepare people who were coming to see their commanders if they were in a good mood or they were not in a good mood. And there was advantages to this, so they could warn the Jews, that the commander knew about this, and then they could stop everything they were doing. So this is why he didn't want anyone. See, the centurion wasn't told anything, because it would have been within their scope to have someone offer them bribes for a little information. And this was a common practice, as it is often in countries like India and the Orient, to get government positions to move up. Bribes are a big thing. It's just another polite word today for what we would call extortion, as the mob did in the 20s and 30s. And this was common practice of how soldiers and lesser officials could make extra money by people bribing them and offering them gifts. They would treat the prisoners better. They would help them. They would do many things because they're being paid to do this. And one of the ways that a slave could get extra tips by informing guests who are coming of certain events or certain things, and it would make their party more pleasant, and they would slide them a little money for this. So this was acceptable, and it was a common practice. Verse 23, and he called to him, this is the commander, two of the centurions, and said, get 200 soldiers ready by the third hour of the night to proceed to Caesarea with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. Centurion, the word itself means 100, over 100. If there was war or dangerous times going on, most likely there would have been 100 soldiers under him. But during peacetime and when they were spread out and they didn't have much to do, sometimes a centurion could be over a few hundred people. And the same with the commander. As we find this commander, his normal authority would have been over 1,000 men. But in some of these areas, and studying Roman history, it was very common at times for some of them to be over several thousand men and be responsible for them. And they would sort of delegate to centurions. They would act as their assistants in these things. But normally when they were going to battle and fight, then they got back to the normal practice, because the way they marched and the way they formed their squares to fight all depended on each one of these centurion knowing how many men he had and what was going to be done. So if the commander had at least 1,000 in peaceful times, the same as a centurion, but we're told literally here that we can add up, there are 470 soldiers. The spearmen, they were trained with these short javelins, we would call spears, and a shorter sword. So they fought differently, and they were a different use than the normal soldiers who carried their longer spears and various other shields and so forth. So there were distinction of what they were trained for. They were to leave at the third hour. This would be 9 o'clock at night when the area was quite dark and it would be quiet. Anytime there were Roman soldiers, Roman commanders, governors in control, they kept curfews pretty good. So you didn't have people wandering around, groups of people doing anything at night. This was not permitted. So they would sort of be more like a curfew type of situation. So they were to take Paul to Caesarea, and this was on the coast. This was a journey over the mountain area, and it was about 60 miles away. This would be where the governor would be, the superior, the chief superior in this province of Judea. Verse 24, and they also were to provide mounts to put Paul on and bring him safely to Felix, the governor. They put him on a horse because it would have been harder for assassins to get to him with a knife or a short sword. They basically would not be using any kind of bow and arrow in this kind of situation. Assassins always use knives and short daggers because they had to conceal them under their clothes. So for them to try to pull him off a horse or get to him, they'd have to get past several other horses and a bunch of soldiers to do this. And this would be another protection. They would not be able to see very well at night, and there was all of these soldiers on both sides and behind. So it would be an impossible situation for someone to run up to Paul and try to stab him while he's on a horse. So this is how serious the commander took this. not only because Paul was a Roman citizen, but because the trouble that would happen if there had been an assassination attempt and it succeeded, there would have been repercussions, and he would have had to and would have asked for instructions on how to punish the Jews and ascertain whether they were involved in this. And things like this had happened often. Even Pilate and some other governors had gone into the temple court and to the very sanctuary and killed priests and people who resisted because of assassination attempts or Romans being killed. It was common sometimes for the zealots. They hate it, as all of them did, didn't like the Romans anyway. But at night sometime, and it's, if they could find a Roman soldier out by himself drunk, they would try to kill him. And if they had any witnesses whatsoever, and it was attributed to the Jews, if they could not find the person, often the governors and the people in charge just went into the court and started slaying young adults and men, because they knew they would have known what was going on, and they would arrest some and torture them. So this was very common, and many riots and upstirrings and so forth had happened. And this is why previously Paul was taken away from the Jewish mob and hauled up to the barracks, because this commander did not want this happening. This was a delicate area, and he did not want to be responsible for rioting breaking out if his superiors felt that he could have prevented it. So he is not just looking out for Paul or that concerned that Paul's a Roman citizen. There are minor issues here. He's looking out for his own neck now, and he wants to make sure if there are 40 men plotting to assassinate a Roman prisoner, this is not good. And he knows that local war and troubles could break out before anything could get out of the city, and there could be hundreds of people killed, and ultimately the Jewish leaders and the Roman leaders in that area would be called to give an account of what was going on. So he believed this. 40 men are going to try to kill him. So he acts and he makes sure that this is not going to happen. So verse 25, so he writes a letter that is going with these 400 and some men. And this is the first time he gives his name here, which was common way of addressing. Instead of saying, dear so-and-so, and we end our letters and so forth with our name, the Roman way, they addressed first who the letter was from. And this is what he does. Laius is his name, Claudius, to the most excellent governor, Felix. Greetings. He will flatter, because it was common practice to do this, not only to use the superior's titles, but at times to flatter. And usually the person sending the letter did not often give his title. It would already been known. So he didn't have to say commander over this. He's trying to be sort of humble, and this was the way it was done. You did not overpresent yourself to a superior, because you could be reprimanded and embarrassed if you did this. So he's just doing what was the normal custom. So this is part of the letter. Verse 27. When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, he makes it plain that he believes the Jewish mob were going to kill Paul. I came up to them with troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. Okay? Interesting. He does not tell the true story. He's covering himself. He doesn't see it necessary to say, we didn't find out till we were ready to beat him and we tied him up. Because even the governor would have looked at this and said, something ain't right here. So he conveniently sort of leaves that part out, that we did ascertain he was a Roman. He makes it sound like he found out he was a Roman citizen while the Jewish mob was in control of him. So we know that was not actually what happened. Verse 28, and wanting to ascertain the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. So here he makes it clear that they went down and sent him to the Jewish sector in the temple and to the meeting place of where the Sanhedrin would meet. And I found him to be accused over questions about their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. He's saying according to Roman law. He's making a distinction here. Because if Paul was not a Roman citizen and he was just a Jew, he would have not have interfered. He would have allowed the Jews to take care of it. And if they wanted him dead officially, they would try him, and they would ask permission from the governor or whoever was in the area. The commander may have had permission on lesser people that weren't of importance, and they could have just put him to death. But he was simply stating, according to Roman law, and this man is a Roman also, found no reason or no judgment against him that he should be killed or even kept in confinement. So this is what he was saying. When I was informed that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, also instructing his accusers to bring charges against him before you. So he's making it very plain. He's done his duty. So the soldiers, in accordance with their order, he's finished his letter here, they took Paul and brought him by night to Antipyris. And this was a little town about 40 miles from Jerusalem. Remember, Caesarea's about 60. Some people believe it took the next night. During the day, Roman soldiers could carry 50 or 60 pounds of equipment. They could march 20, 25 miles. But because he was leaving at night, they were going across the mountain. Definitely they did not get there while it was still dark. It would not have happened. So it was most likely the following night that they arrived in this area, this town. But the next day, leaving the horsemen to go on with him, they returned to the barracks. So what we have is the 70 horsemen proceeded the next 20 miles to Caesarea, and the 400 foot soldiers, they began to return to Jerusalem. They saw there was no threat by the Jews. They're proceeding into more Roman territory. Of course, all of it was under them. But Caesarea was the headquarters of the Roman governor. It basically had a lot more soldiers and a lot more Roman people there than Jewish people. We'll go from 33 to 35. And when these had come to Caesarea, the 70, they delivered the letter to the governor, and they also presented Paul to him. And when he had read it, he asked from what province he or Paul was from, and he learned that he was from Caesarea. And verse 35, and he said, I will give you a hearing after your accusers arrive also. So he gave orders for him to be kept in Herod's palace. Okay, we have here, this was the Roman governor's area. They had taken over these palaces. The palace and the buildings and everything, they were called Herod's palace still, for Herod the Great had built it. Remember, he was the one who sought to kill the baby Jesus. He died about 4 B.C. or something. And then his son took over. Some say his nephew, but it was a relative. And he was a great builder. He was well known. He had much to do with the building of the Jewish temple, providing a lot of white marble and everything. And actually, he had a palace up at the fortress that we know as Masada. He had a palace with, I've been up there, it had hot water, it had baths. Herod, all three, there was four of them actually, but all of them were more pro-Roman, and they took on Roman ways often in things that they do. They were all usually despised by the Jew because the Herods were partially Sumerian too, so actually the Jews as a whole didn't think much of them. They considered them part Gentile dogs. That would be their reasoning. But the reason they always seem to maintain power is Caligula, the wicked, the perverted Caesar, and one before him, Tiberius, the Herods had ingratiated themselves to them, and them and their people had been in Jerusalem, and they were good fighters, and actually some of them were close friends to the emperor. And so that's how most of them got their appointments and did not get removed when certain political events went on. They were really a wicked bunch, but that's who we were dealing with. Herod had built most of the area up at Caesarea, and it became a Roman occupation. A Roman ships came in there, much was brought in, and so the Roman governor often stayed in this area. He did not care to stay in Jerusalem permanently, but he had a place there when he visited or when he had to go for official reasons. So that's why they still call it Herod's palace. Okay, we're in chapter 24 now, verse 1. After 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders with an attorney named Tutelus, and they brought charges to the governor against Paul. So this is interesting. We see how important they had failed, the priest and some of the elders, of having Paul assassinated, but they were so incensed against him, they wanted him, and they wanted him dead. And so the high priest himself would have been unusual. So it shows you his animosity. He's going to make a special trip 60 miles to come down with some representatives of the Sanhedrin, and they want Paul. They want him under their control, and they want him dead. And so we can see they thought this was important enough to do this. Verse 2, after Paul had been summoned, Tutelius began to accuse him, saying to the governor, "Since we have through you attained much peace, and since by your providence reforms are being carried out for this nation." So as they meet, it would be like a preliminary hearing. Paul had been summoned, and Tutelus began to accuse him before the governor. And he said, "Since we have through you attained much peace, and since by your providence reforms are being carried out." He's flattering him. He's a smooth lawyer. He proceeds to do this, and this is typically what we expect lawyers to do. But he would be an eloquent speaker. You notice it would not be the high priest or someone from the Sanhedrin. They would get the best. And so he was their lawyer. And he would know what was proper. Them being more Jewish would not want to really have to deal personally with a Roman or a Gentile governor. So in a way, that's the way they saved face. And this guy would be trained and know how to approach, how to flatter, what he could do and what he couldn't do. He did not want to offend the governor before they got their case presented. And often these governors and these people in power, they had a lot of latitude. And if you insulted them or you said something they didn't think was right, they could dismiss the case just because they didn't want to hear it. So, you know, a lot of things were done like this. So he's presenting a good face for his employers here. Verse 3, "We acknowledge this in every way and everywhere, most excellent Felix, with all thankfulness." Now again, this is really laying it on with the trial, because the Jews never liked to flatter Romans. They didn't like them occupying them. They didn't like them in control. But this is a lawyer, so he knows how to play this game. He's done his homework. And he already knows about this governor, what his likes and dislikes are, and so forth. He was known to be sort of a wicked man, like the Herod. He was not very honest. We find that historically wise, he was like the typical Roman governor. When they were sent to different places, when certain generals under Caesar's time and so forth, as rewards often, when they served their terms and they were generals with great influence, as a reward for them, they were sent to outer provinces of the Roman Empire, and they were appointed governors. And this basically meant they ruled as kings. And as long as they presented a certain amount of the taxes and the money back to Rome, they could extort more, they could flatter, they could threaten under the table. And often this is how they became rich. So often these generals, and even some senators sometimes, they looked and they were considered a great honor if the emperor wanted to give them one of these posts, because they could act as a mini king and they didn't have to answer nobody. And it was reward often for the service they had did for Rome. So this man would have been able to make money and make himself rich, and he would have no scruples of being crooked and taking bribes if on the surface, and if it was not blatant and he could be sneaky about it, then it was acceptable practice for the people in those positions. And he was no exception to the rule. Okay, verse 4, "But that I may not weary you any further." He is probably, after he's put on all this flattery, the governor is probably not that vain. He's heard all this before. And if he proceeds much in this vein, he's going to be rebuked or something's going to be said to him. So he understands the guy's showing him respect, and that's enough. But he don't want him to overdo it, because then it makes him look like a fool. So that's why he may see the expression on the governor's face. He's getting tired of this. Get to the point. So immediately he says, I'm not going to weary you anymore. And that's probably what he was doing. So he says, I beg you to grant us by your kindness a brief hearing. Verse 5, for we have found this man a real pest, I like the word they use, and a fellow who stirs up dissension among all the Jews throughout the world. The term used world is the inhabited earth. Often these expressions are used because the Roman world was the world. Anything past Egypt south, anything too far east, they were considered barbarian and didn't know much about them. They weren't considered a great name, so they didn't give no thought to them. They would be more like just little tribes that don't count. So the Roman world was the world at this time. It was the political world that involved any nation that was of any importance, because they were all either under Rome's control, or they were provinces, or they were allies. And so this is why he's saying this throughout the world. He's exaggerating also, because we know, and we've been studying in Acts, the places that Paul has gone. And he has not gone to many places in the Roman world. But they're exaggerating this to let him know that he's just stirring up a lot of trouble everywhere he goes. So again, this would be an exaggeration. And he's a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. So he's letting them know that we do not consider him a good Jew. He's a troublemaker among our own people. Of course, they cannot deny his Judaism. And so that's why he'll use the term, he's a sect. But he's clever at doing this, because if they acknowledge that this is a sect of Judaism, then officially they can be judged by the Jewish Sanhedrin. So see, he's clever on all of this. He knows what, and he's hoping the governor will give him back to them and let them take Paul back to Jerusalem so they can handle him the way that they want to. So this is what they're after. A ringleader. So they recognized Paul as, and from rumor, that he had authority on an order that Peter had, that the half-brother, the Apostle James, had, because they mainly maintained their ministries in Judea and Jerusalem, yet Paul was opening up the ministry to Gentiles, getting many converts, and when he would go on various Sabbaths, the first two or three, to the synagogues, we've seen from previous lessons and reading, he got converts, and sometimes he'd draw them out if they were being persecuted. And all of this is being reported ultimately back to the Sanhedrin. And then when these people every year go back and forth for various feast and Passover, they're telling what's going on and the troubles they've had, so they know what Paul is up to. Remember, he was one of them at one time. Verse 6, and he even tried to desecrate the temple, and then we arrested him. Again, we find this is exaggeration and a lie. We wanted to judge him according to our own law. What they wanted to do was to try him by hook or by crook. They couldn't get him legally according to their own law. They couldn't have done what they wanted. He was not worthy of death. The most they could have done when he said what he did about the high priest and spoke out loud, they could have given him a few strikes for that. That's the extent that they could have done to him under the law of Moses. But they were determined to kill him, remember, so they didn't care how they did it. And I'm sure the governor has been informed of these things and was still getting information on these things. Okay? But Lysias, the commander, came along. Now they're going to badmouth him, verse 7, and with much violence took him out of our hands. Well, to a degree, this was true. So notice what was very common for them to do. They did not like the fact, it was an insult to them, that the commander had Paul removed immediately that night. They don't bring up the point that there was an assassination plot that 40 men are going to do. They want to blame him, and not only did he do this, but when he took Paul from down in the courtyards areas where the mob was talking to him, he did it by violence, and most likely this was true. When he first went down there to get Paul before they beat him to death, it would have been nothing. It was the Roman way. They would have gone down there and yelled and told him, get aside. And if the Jews, which was probably happening, some of the violent vocal ones would probably start yelling and screaming. And the Romans had no use for this. They'd start beating them. They'd drive them out of the way and beat them. so they could get to Paul. So if they did not comply immediately, there would be violence. And the Romans had no compunction about doing this. That was their way. You obeyed them. You did what you were told. And if you didn't, there were consequences. And the Jews never did what they were told. They were always argumentative. They always wanted to have the last say. They were hated by the Romans, as the Jews didn't like them. The Romans didn't like Jews either. And they were punished on several occasions. And ultimately, they were punished like no other province had been punished in century. Ultimately, when they destroyed the temple and killed half of the Jews, they made a special law, the emperor did, that it could no longer be a province. They were deciding to put them in their place once and for all. So they were often very argumentative. They had been ordered from Rome on several occasions for doing and saying things when they should have been quiet. But they didn't, and they reaped the consequences because of this. So he's saying he took him out of our hands. Yeah, they were plotting to kill him. Order his accusers to come before you. Well, that is true. By examining him yourselves concerning all these matters, you will be able to ascertain the things which we accuse him. What he's saying is you're going to find that we are truthful. And later on, Paul's going to basically say all of it was lies. They have no proof of any of this. Obviously, Paul was a debater. Paul knew the Jewish law, and Paul knew how to defend certain positions. And he was a Roman, so he would have known, and we'll see, he knows Roman law. And so he knows when to call that into play and when to let it slide. So they're not just dealing with any country bumpkin. This is a man who was a Pharisee of Pharisees. This is why they wanted him dead. He was their star hero, and all of a sudden he goes over to the enemy as far as they're concerned. He's a traitor by promoting Christianity, by promoting a person they considered a false prophet and a false Messiah. Okay? So it says at this time, after he finishes speaking, the Jews also join in the attack, this is verbally, asserting that these things were so. So after this smooth lawyer makes his eloquent speech, the high priest and some elders join in this verbal attack. The Jewish leaders are so determined to get Paul that the high priest has come all the way down to Caesarea and made a showing, all the way down from Jerusalem. So this is what's going on. We will stop here and continue. In the next lesson, Paul will be speaking for about 10 or 11 verses. Oh, Lord, give us wisdom in your word. Help us to see the practical application and your providential dealings through what we read. In Jesus' name, amen.